And this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Palestinians rally for the Gaza funerals of protesters killed by Israeli forces.
There are still protests going on. They're much smaller in terms of the amount of people that had turned up today.
The coalition headed by anti-U.S. Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr appears headed to victory in Iraq's parliamentary election. And singer Childish Gambino's new single explores violence in America. It's all ahead. Thousands of Palestinian mourners rallied in Gaza Tuesday at funerals for the first of dozens of protesters killed in border clashes with Israeli security forces. United Nations human rights officials condemn the violence as appalling. Many of the mourners wave Palestinian flags, and some call for revenge against Israel for the 60 who were killed and the 2,700 wounded on Monday. These mourners grieve for a baby that was killed by tear gas. New protests broke out along the Gaza border with Israel and in the West Bank, with demonstrators hurling rocks at the Israelis and setting fires as Israeli forces fired tear gas in response. But the number of protesters appeared to be substantially smaller than the 40,000 who demonstrated along the Gaza border Monday in opposition to the opening of the new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, less than 100 kilometers away. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley said Tuesday Israel used restraint in response to the deadly clashes with Palestinians at the Gaza border, and she blamed Gaza's ruling Hamas militant group for the violence.
Those who suggest that the Gaza violence has anything to do with the location of the American embassy are sorely mistaken. Rather, the violence comes from those who reject the existence of the State of Israel in any location. Such a motivation, the destruction of a United Nations member state, is so illegitimate as to not be worth our time in the Security Council, other than the time it takes to denounce it.
VOA Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch is in the Gaza Strip. She describes to me the situation there Tuesday.
Well, today there are funerals going on. The hospitals are packed from yesterday. There are still protests going on. They're much smaller in terms of the amount of people that had turned up today. However, they are equally intense in terms of the amount of tear gas raining down on the protesters. So it's still a pretty hectic situation, even though many more people stayed home or went to funerals or the hospital than went to protest today.
Well, apparently there has also been criticism by members of the international community against Israel for using live fire against the Palestinian protesters.
Well, it is certainly true that there has been fire against Palestinian protesters. Many people have been shot. The Palestinian authorities say they are rubber bullets with metal coating. Protesters say they believe the bullets are somehow explosive, but we're talking about people who experience them and experience extreme pain, so I don't know if that's coming from any place of expertise or simply just the pain. I did see many people that had been injured by gunfire, though, so there's no doubt that that's been happening.
Well, now, meanwhile, the United States is saying the militant group Hamas has set off the protests. Have you seen indications of that?
Well, certainly Hamas is the leading governing body in the Gaza Strip. It's the most powerful organization and also has the most powerful militant group. And they have been leading the protests, at least from behind. They're the ones that encouraged them to start. They put up the signs. However, there is also no doubt that the youth of the Gaza Strip and of the adults as well, for the most part, but not across the board, very much do support the idea of protests because they are angry about the fact that they believe that the land, particularly Jerusalem, belongs to them and not to Israel. So there is some truth in that Hamas is behind the protests, but it's also true that the people, for the most part, followed suit, not out of force, but out of passion.
Now, today is the 70th anniversary of what the Palestinians are calling the Nakba, what they see as the mass displacement following the creation of Israel. Have there been any special ceremonies or commemorations of that today?
We spent some time with a family this morning that say that they generally don't do anything particular for the Nakba. And the protests that happened today were a continuation of protests that have been going on for 6 weeks. However, it is something that's very much on people's mind. It is something that happened 70 years ago, but it's something they talk about every single day since then. People still own or have the deeds to the homes that they left or their forefathers left in 1948. And there's a very strong sense of ownership, even young people saying, I want to go home to my place that my grandfather or great-grandfather left in 1948. So there's a certain anger that comes up with Nakba every year, and that was certainly true today.
Heather, are there indications that protests will continue?
There's a split opinion on the ground here in Gaza about whether the protests will continue. Officially, this is the end of protests that have been scheduled for 6 weeks to culminate in the opening of the U.S. Embassy and Nakba. However, many people are saying they intend to continue protesting for the next month until June 15th. So it's unclear whether or not they will continue. Ramadan begins tomorrow, which means people will be fasting, which means there could be a considerable amount more of tiredness in the local population to keep this up. But some young people are saying they won't stop.
VOA Middle East correspondent Heather Murdoch reporting from the Gaza Strip. Well, joining me on the line is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's happening?
Well, I just want to follow up from what we just heard from Heather there. She was saying that Ramadan begins tomorrow, meaning Wednesday, the 16th of May. Well, that may or may not be true. The setting of Ramadan and the beginning of Ramadan, it's a lunar Islamic holiday, and it is set in each country by that country's religious officials. So it's still very much an open question whether Ramadan begins on the 16th or the 17th. Lots of people talking about Ramadan, its beginning, and then a month later, of course, after the end of this month-long fast, the Eid al-Fitr, when that will come. Here's Haramain. It is a Saudi news service. The moon has not been sighted in Saudi Arabia. That means Ramadan will commence on the night of the 16th. But then, however, here's Karman, the first day of Ramadan. This is Ramadan 1439, for those who are interested. It's actually confirmed for Thursday, the 17th of May. So people, various people in various countries, here's one from a news service called Top Islamic Tweets. Ramadan Mubarak, the moon was not sighted tonight in Indonesia. So Ramadan will begin tomorrow and fasting will begin on Thursday the 17th. Here's Gulf News, the moon could not be sighted tonight. The first day of Ramadan will be Thursday, May 17th. So say Saudi news sources and the Gulf News. Of course, lots of people also sending out good Ramadan wishes. And of course, it's a feast. Excuse me, it's not a feast. It's a fast during the daylight hours. So interestingly, the last thing that I've been seeing, it's circulating around the internet a lot, is what country you live on depends on how long you're actually going to be fasting. And so fasting hours apparently in Iceland, no surprise, are going to be the longest this Islamic Ramadan, a total of 21 hours and 51 minutes. Of course, the closer you are to the equator, the shorter your fast is going to be. So that explains the unfortunate, I guess, situation for Muslims in Iceland. Anyway, lots and lots of people talking about Ramadan and actually sending out lots and lots and lots of wishes for peace during this month. And that's encouraging to see.
All right. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Russian President Vladimir Putin drives a truck across a new bridge linking Russia to Crimea. President Trump says his wife Melania is recovering from a medical procedure and she will leave the hospital within days. A Moscow court orders Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny to be jailed for 30 days following protests, and the U.S. sanctions the head of Iran's central bank. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study published in the journal PLOS Biology supports past research that suggests the more weight you gain, the less you are able to taste the food you eat. The study, based on research with mice, suggests that obesity-driven inflammation can actually reduce the number of taste buds on the tongue. There are 50 to 100 receptor cells in each taste bud. These receptor cells are said to have a short lifespan, dying off in about 10 days. As cells die, they are replaced with new ones. The researchers note that a group of obese mice fed a high-fat diet had about 25% fewer taste buds than mice in the lean group fed a normal diet. The study found that the rate of dying taste bud cells increased in the obese mice, while the regeneration of their new taste cells slowed. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a prominent American writer has died. We'll hear all about it. It appears that candidates backed by Iraqi Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr are the big winners following Sunday's parliamentary election, the first since the Islamic State was defeated. Results indicate his bloc will secure the most seats, followed by Iran-backed Shiite militia leader Hadi al-Amiri's candidates, with those backing incumbent Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi coming in third. Sadr is viewed as hostile to both the United States and Iran, but he cannot become prime minister because he was not a candidate. His bloc will be involved with others trying to form a coalition government. James Jeffrey, a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a former ambassador, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it will take time for that coalition to emerge.
Take a step back. There are 329 seats in the parliament. Muqtada's party, al-Sadr's party, will have 54, which is roughly over one-seventh. Ho-hum. Alawi got 91 seats, almost a third of the seats in 2010, and he didn't become the prime minister, and his party was left out in the cold. It wasn't a great day for Iran because they had two primary candidates, Maliki and, again, Hadi al-Amri. Between them got roughly 69 votes. The problem is it wasn't a great day for America because Abadi, who America was quietly supporting, came in third, which, as you said, 42 votes. And the Kurds did less well. The two key parties, the PUK and the KDP, did less well than they have in the past. They lost about 15 seats down to 40. And so there's no way that you can form a clear-cut pro-American coalition. But the real effort in any Iraqi election takes place after the voting because nobody ever wins. Rather, it's negotiating among the various blocs who are sharing 10% of the vote, 5% of the vote, 20% of the vote.
Would a new coalition government possibly tell U.S. troops to leave?
It's a little bit more complicated than when I was there in 2011 because the U.S. troops are there as part of an international coalition, and they have a specific mission. We didn't have a specific mission other than train and equip. That is, you still have a residual mopping up effort against ISIS. This doesn't require a positive act. Last time it required a parliamentary vote. Basically, Iraq has agreed that these guys stay on, so you have to take a positive act to ask them to go. And the question is, why would a new prime minister do that?
You also, of course, said this was not a particularly good day for Iran. How much influence does Iran have in Iraqi politics today?
Iran has tremendous blocking and considerable shaping. Blocking means it's very hard to form an anti-Iranian anything in Iraq because it has economic power, it has military power through its control of militias, and it has political power through it, politicians and political parties that tend to answer to it. But it's not 10 feet high. They have to deal with the Kurds in the north and the Sunnis, Arabs in the west are very nervous about Iran and its proxies. Grand Ayatollah Sistani and the Shia clerics in Najaf, the religious leadership of the Shia, has been in a long-term theological conflict with the Qom strain of Shia Islam, that is represented by the Islamic State and the Supreme Leader Khamenei.
James Jeffries said Iraq has achieved some limited success in recent years, weathering falling oil prices, defeating Islamic State, and reaching some accommodation with the autonomous Kurds in the north. He said whatever the makeup of the new Iraqi government, its key challenges will be addressing the economic needs of the Iraqi people and reducing Iranian influence in the country. Tom Wolfe, the white-suited symbol of new journalism who chronicled American culture from the merry pranksters through the space race before turning his satiric wit to such novels as The Bonfire of the Vanities and A Man in Full, has died. He was 88 years old. Lynn Nesbitt, Wolfe's literary agent, told the Associated Press that he died of an infection Monday in a New York City hospital. Further details were not immediately available. Wolfe's literary honors included the American Book Award, now called the National Book Award for The Right Stuff, and a nomination for the National Book Critics Circle Prize for The Bonfire of the Vanities, one of the top 10 selling books of the 1980s. Its 1998 follow-up, A Man in Full, was another bestseller and a National Book Award nominee. Wolfe satirized college misbehavior in I Am Charlotte Simmons and was still at it in his 80s with Back to Blood, a sprawling multicultural story of sex and honor set in Miami. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. The new number one single is by a multi-talented singer-songwriter. VOA's Border Crossing host Larry London joins me with the latest.
Well, today, Sarah, we are going to be checking out a brand new song from an actor, a singer, a songwriter, a man who has two identities. He's an Emmy winner from television's show Atlanta, and he's a Grammy winner for his hit song Redbone. His name is Donald Glover, or Childish Gambino. As a musician, as a singer-songwriter, he goes by the alias Childish Gambino, which he's used for several years. And earlier in the year, he had said that he's going to retire from music. Then all of a sudden, he signed a new publishing deal and said, nope, guess what? I'm not retiring from music. In fact, he's going out on tour this summer. Everybody's excited about it. And now he's got his very first number one hit song, the following to Redbone, which was a Grammy winner, as I mentioned last year. This song is called This Is America. So let's give it a listen.
This is America. Don't got you slipping up. Look how I'm living up. Police be tripping up. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area.
My area.
I got the strap. I gotta carry 'em. Yeah, yeah, I'm gonna go into this.
Do you know how he got that name of Childish Gambino?
No, I have no idea. He doesn't talk about it. It's kind of an alter ego of his, and he jokes around a lot. In fact, he was the host slash musical guest of Saturday Night Live last weekend. He went on the show, and he said, you know, I'm going to be Donald Glover, the host, and I'm going to be Childish Gambino, the performer, which he was. He's got quite an illustrious past. If you look at all the awards he's got and the TV shows, he started off as a writer for 30 Rock, and then he went on to star on the show Community. And following that, he started to star in and co-write the FX hit show Atlanta, which I mentioned a little while ago. Got an Emmy for his role there and Best Actor in a Television Series. He's done some films as well. His most recent was in Star Wars, Han Solo. He's in that film. And he's also going to be the voice of Simba opposite Beyonce in the action remake of A Lion King when it comes out in 2019. So he's going to be Simba. He's going to be the lead character. So I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, Childish Gambino slash Donald Glover in that role. Right now, musically, his follow-up album, his last album, was called Awaken My Love, but he's working on a new album. This is the first song to come off of the new album. He hasn't released any information about it, other than I anticipate it'll be out in the summer, right around the time that he goes on tour, because that's typically what an artist does. They release an album, then go on tour to support the album. So the new song, This Is America, all about America, and it takes a look from a black man's perspective, because he refers to, you know, being a black man in the song several times. So it's a very interesting song, debuting at number one, knocking Drake off the top of the charts.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's pretty unusual to have someone who's a successful actor and a successful music artist as well. Very unusual.
And he's so talented, not only as an artist, but as a songwriter, too. He's a great writer, which we know from his TV and film days. And, I mean, People Magazine have given him lots of props. He was on the Time Magazine Most Influential People in the World issue. So he's one to watch. His star is on the rise, and he's been nothing but popular and successful since his debut in 2011. And so we're looking forward to the new album, whatever it might be called, whenever it might be coming out. I'm sure it'll be this summer.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. That is the sound of This Is America by Childish Gambino. And that brings an end to our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the Organization of American States, Vice President Mike Pence quoted the charter of the OAS. Representative democracy is an indispensable condition for stability, peace, and development. Free nations throughout the hemisphere, he stated, can attest to that truth. But there are places in the hemisphere under a dark cloud of tyranny, Vice President Pence said, among them Cuba, where the police state imposed by the Castro family remains, and Nicaragua, where hundreds of thousands have taken to the streets to demand a return to democratic order, only to be met in some instances with deadly force. It is in Venezuela, however, where the tragedy of tyranny is on full display. Grinding poverty, corruption, oppression, and exile are the results of authoritarian misrule by President Nicolas Maduro, who has replaced the country's once great democracy with dictatorship. If the Venezuelan people had the chance, they would choose a better path. The vice president called the upcoming May 20th elections in Venezuela a fraud and a sham. The regime callously portions out access to affordable food to manipulate votes. The courts and the electoral council are packed with Maduro cronies. Major parties have been banned, opposition leaders have been barred from running, and dissidents jailed.
And that's why today we call on Maduro and his regime, suspend this sham election. Give the people of Venezuela real choices, because the Venezuelan people deserve to live in democracy once again.
Vice President Pence noted that in order to hold the Maduro regime responsible for the chaos it has caused, the U.S. has imposed, among other measures, strict financial sanctions on more than 50 current and former senior officials, and has barred the Petro digital currency from the U.S. financial system. Vice President Pence called on nations in the Western Hemisphere to do more to stand with Venezuela's people by suspending Venezuela from membership in the organization, cutting off Venezuela's corrupt leaders from laundering money through their country's financial systems, and enacting visa restrictions that prevent Venezuela's leaders from entering their nations. The people of Venezuela deserve democracy, Mr. Pence said. The people of Venezuela deserve to regain their libertad.
That was an editorial.